in old school, and you never have to take another day of the cruelty.
The thugs and the fools and the...
It's true, I wear a collar and a tie. I make the wind blow all the while. They say I do it. Ain't nobody caught me. You sure got to prove it on me.
Take a walk on the wild side. I said, hey babe, take a walk on the wild side.
Chocolate covered rainbows, black boys get on down, down.
Every G&L has a New York Tales tale. The Stonewall was everyone.
Let them take you and make you invisible.
Good evening and welcome to Fresh Fruit, the longest running weekly queer radio show in the country, every Thursday from 7 to 8 p.m. I'm your host, Dixie Treichel, and tonight on Fresh Fruit, my guests are Carrie Pickett, an award-winning filmmaker, photographer, author, and artist, and Dawn Mickelson, an Emmy Award-winning producer who's completed 7 award-winning independent feature documentaries. Their recent feature film, Their recent documentary film, Uncle Roy, is about Carrie's gay uncle, Roy Blakey, who was a professional theatrical ice skater, trailblazing photographer, and creator of his ice stage archives with over 44,000 items. Uncle Roy made its world premiere in March 2026 at the Thessaloniki International Documentary Film Festival in Greece, and its North American premiere last week at the Minneapolis-St. Paul International Film Festival. Carrie and Dawn, welcome.
Woohoo.
Thank you for having us.
All right.
Yeah, what a history.
Woohoo. Yeah, well, both of you, man. You made my head was hurting, you know, when I was reading your bios. It's like so many awards and so many different things you've done. But let's start, just talk a little bit about yourselves, and then, you know, we can go into Uncle Roy and the other projects that you've been working on. So, Carrie, talk a little bit about what your background is and what you're doing.
Well, I wasn't born in Minnesota, but I claim it. And I've grew up in Minnesota and went to school up at Morehead State University at the time. And when I graduated, I moved to New York City and got an internship at the Village Voice newspaper as a photojournalist, and really grew up as a photojournalist and photographer, and focused on books and making books. And I'm very family focused, and so I made my first film because of my uncle, and he really inspired me as a photographer and a filmmaker. And so I just have been really lucky to be somebody who gets to be allowed into other people's lives to then share it as art and journalism and entertainment.
And Dawn?
Well, I'm going to try to parallel Carrie's structure. So I grew up in Minnesota, and I got my degree at UMD, Duluth, University of Minnesota, Duluth, poli-sci and women's studies with a minor in music because I couldn't help myself. And then, you know, I got my first job outside of college was a television news reporter for WDIO, which was the ABC affiliate in Duluth. And really fell in love with, you know, the medium of storytelling, visual storytelling, but wanted to do long form. Television news in particular was a little too short with 30-second stories, and I wanted to, you know, go into that space of the gray space, the gray area of our conversations, so that, you know, we could really get into the meat of things. So, yeah, and you read the bio, so I've made a bunch of films. my first film was actually called Treading Water, and it was with my partner Jamie Lee at the time, and that film was about being queer in rural northern Minnesota. And it was us and our friends. And little did we know, or little did I know, that that would be the beginning of a almost now 30-year career making documentary films.
So for both of you, you've both made lots of documentary films. Is that your main focus? Like, what drew you to doing documentary film as opposed to another style of film?
Well, I can mirror Dawn's interest in long-form storytelling. And even as a photographer, I really found that I would work on projects over a long time. My book on radical fairies that came out in the year 2000 about the Radical Fairy Sanctuary Kawashoe in northern Minnesota, and about radical placing it in the history of the radical fairy movement. That book took me 7 years to make.
Wow.
I worked documenting the Tibetan American Resettlement Project here in Minnesota. We're lucky to have the largest Tibetan community outside of New York State here, and I've photographed in that community for 20 years. And so I've always been interested in books and in storytelling, and so when my uncle would come home from these figure skating reunions all hoarse, and he could hardly talk, and he had been having so much fun, and he had this huge collection of the history of theatrical ice skating, I thought, oh my God, you know, that would really make an interesting story. This history is so important in American entertainment. It dominated live entertainment for four decades. And I told every filmmaker I knew, you know, wow, there's this awesome story that's in my uncle's archive. He has this entire history about this story, and somebody needs to do a film about it. And when nobody stepped up to do it, I thought, well, I better do it. I mean, I'm the one who seems to be, you know, blabbing about it. And so I bought a camera, and I hired a grad student from the University of Minnesota, who was a grad student in film, to come over and teach me how to edit. I paid her to teach me, and I started making short videos on the path to making my first documentary film, The Fabulous Ice Age. And that film took me 8 years to make, because I didn't know what I was doing when I started. I mean, I'm in awe of Dawn's career, that she's really always been in filmmaking and media. And you know, it really took me a long time. And then with that first film, then I had the bug, and I was not going to turn back. I'm still interested in photography, and I'd still have some books in me that I'd like to finish. But really, I feel like I am a documentary filmmaker now.
Mm-hmm. And how about you, Dawn? What drew you to documentary filmmaking?
I think it's a combination of things, but I will say that, you know, it's probably a combination of having a theater background and then learning how to edit and recognizing the power of personal stories to impact our lives. You know, like when I was in theater, you'd perform, and then right afterwards people would come up to you and be like, oh my God, that was my story too. And I loved that, but I didn't want to be an actress necessarily. I was, you know, so it pivoted when I was like, and I also love this thing called editing, where you get to, you know, mix visuals and audio, and, you know, it was like collage on this massive scale, and I just loved that. And so, yeah, I mean, once I did the news thing, I was like, I'm solidly in the documentary film realm. I will say that I had an internship just before the news gig at Wisconsin Public Radio.
Ooh.
And that's one of those roads not traveled for me. And actually, I just, I'm going to be releasing a podcast next week.
All
right. And it's the first time I've done audio. And so it feels like coming home in that way. And mm-hmm. like, you know, that's where I started. And here I am back in the audio world. But mm-hmm. everything else has been documentary film.
Yeah. Well, talk a little bit about your podcast. What's that going to be about? And
yeah.
You know.
So it's called Becoming Lake City. And it is, I'm doing three episodes. It's very small. It was funded by the Southeast Minnesota Regional Arts Council. I think that was it. And I'm focusing on the stories of the people that make up this small town that I moved to. So I now live in Lake City, Minnesota, mm-hmm. population somewhere around 5,000. And I wanted to get to know my community better, get to know who makes up a small town and what makes a town what it is. And really, it's the people who live there. Mm-hmm. And so this season is, just three short stories of people who make a difference in the community and the struggles they've maybe faced over time. And we'll see what happens. If the community likes it, maybe I'll do season two. We'll mm-hmm. see.
Yeah. But. And maybe there'll be a film about a podcaster. Who knows?
Who knows?
You'll have good audio.
I'll have great audio.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah. So both of you have made many films. Just give us a little snippet of some of your past films. We're going to be talking about Uncle Roy, which is the one that just came out. Mm-hmm. But, give us a little bit about what you've done in your other filmmaking.
I will say that I started out making films primarily. You make films on what you know and your community and the people around you. And so, the first film was Treading Water, which was my community in northern Minnesota. And then I moved on to a film called This Obedience that was the story of the Reverend Anita Hill in St. Paul and her extraordinary ordination that was against Lutheran Church policy at that time because she was an out lesbian in a committed relationship. Mm-hmm. And, she just also happened to be my pastor. And much like Carrie's story of, somebody ought to do this, sitting there at church being like, somebody ought to tell this story. We're doing crazy stuff here. And I was like, I guess that's us. I guess we're doing that story. So, yeah. And then, over time, my stories have gone to different subject matter, although I will say that almost every film there is a queer protagonist, not intentionally, but again, you cover the people you know. I'm drawn to stories of ordinary people who are doing extraordinary things and, people who are changing the world who you may never know. I'm also interested in that kind of in-between space that that the short form can't get to. I did a film called Risking Light that was about forgiving the unforgivable, mm-hmm. and started with a story about Mary Johnson and O'Shea Israel in North Minneapolis, and their stories had always been covered as that he murdered her son, she forgave him, now they're together, yay. And I was blown away by the story, but also that it's a lot more complicated to forgive somebody who's murdered your child. Mm-hmm. And so that film kind of met into that messy middle of forgiveness, of how do you get from point A of devastation and trauma to point Z of forgiveness, and why would you do it? And mm-hmm. so that film tackled that through three different stories from people in different countries to kind of look at that idea of forgiveness as something that happens beyond beyond any kind of religious constraints, that it is a universal value of humanity. So, I don't mm-hmm. know. Now I'm lost. What did I say?
Okay, so you were,
telling about your films.
Oh, I was. Okay. So, I like the messy middle, I guess.
Maybe. Yeah. Uh-huh. And so then you moved on to, what was it, Finding Her Beat and
that's where Carrie
Minnesota
and I connected.
Mean. Yeah.
Yeah, so Carrie and I connected over Finding Her Beat, which was the story of a bunch of powerful taiko drumming women who came together to do the first concert of the top players from the U.S. and Japan at the Ordway, top female players. The taiko had been only for men. Historically. And so this is, them saying we play too. And in fact, we play pretty damn well. Oop, darn well. Can I do that word? Too late now. Sorry.
You're okay.
And I met Carrie. I met Carrie a little bit before that and brought her on to Finding Her Beat. And very quickly, we realized that we were really good partners and had complementary skills in storytelling. And so learning through that film, we have been partnering on a lot of things ever since.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I told her I don't ever want to do a film without her. Really. No, it's just, you know, after doing films on my own, by myself, producing is so much better in when you have somebody else there, too.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so you met and you started working together and collaborating. Because now I've noticed on a couple of the films that I saw that you're doing, Uncle Roy and Finding Your Beat, it seems like, Dawn, you're in the editing realm, producing and editing, and Carrie's in the producing and directing and cinematography realm. Is that kind of how your main interests go?
We have a lot of hats, and we're sharing a lot of hats. Okay. In Finding Her Beat, we were co-directors, and Dawn produced it with Jen Weir of Tyco Arts Midwest, who was the one of the principal participants in the film, and made the whole thing just, you know, be like a rocket ship to the moon successful.
Jen's a rock star.
Yeah, Jen's just amazing. And so then with this film, and then with Finding Her Beat, we both edited. I started at the beginning of the process, and Dawn was at the end of the process. And then I've always been the director of photography of all my films. And then I have brought Dawn on with really helping her find her sea legs in camera work more.
It's true. I've been avoiding it for years, and Carrie keeps thrusting cameras into my hands and being like, it's fine, you take this. and she sets it up for me, so by the time we're actually filming, I'm like, I can do this. This is fine, but it is not something I choose to do. And I think I would only do it with Carrie.
Yeah, no, so, you know, we really have both worn all the hats that we wear on a film we both know well, because we've both done almost everything by ourselves, and then we've been in partnership. But I will say that Finding Her Beat was the first film where I was not the producer, and I saw what it looked like to have a really accomplished producer, and I really had been accomplished. My first film, you know, The Fabulous Ice Age, was on Netflix in 10 languages.
Wow.
And so that was a big, and so it's not like I didn't know how to be successful, but I really feel like my producing skills are not the same as Dawn's. And like she said, we complement each other very well. And so just the process, the creative process, is made so much more fun when you have somebody else to talk about the visions, the, you know, where you're at, where you're going, and to spread those joys and sorrows around. Because documentary filmmaking is, you know, not brain surgery, but I wouldn't say it's easy.
I like that. Not brain surgery, but not easy either.
Yeah.
Well, it must be an extreme challenge for the editor, because making a documentary, you're collecting, right? Just gathering all of this. I suppose with any film, there's a ton of footage, but, you know, how do you decide then to, you know, make that editor's choice, you know?
Yeah, no, I would say it's a combination of things, in the sense that, you know, there's what you think the film's going to be, and you throw all of that on the timeline, and then that film is 8 hours long, and you're like, that's too long. so you refine and refine and refine, and it's a combination, I think, of, you know, gut instinct of having done it for so long and being like, you kind of have a sense of rhythm after a while, but also feedback from, you know, diverse groups of viewers. So, you know, like, well, we ran Uncle Roy by, I'm trying to think who we ran Uncle Roy by.
Well, the first group was my sister was working as a with a company that worked with USAID in Africa, and I was lucky enough to be there on two different trips where I showed Uncle Roy in two different iterations to a group of, I would call them young people in Africa, Europeans from Belgium, Germany, you know, all over Europe. And they gave me feedback on the film. And I would say theirs was the first feedback for over the first number of months of us getting to a place where we could really show other people, because that takes a long time. I think Dawn edited for over a year and a half.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, mm-hmm. But then it goes to, you know, people you trust who have done this before, so other documentary filmmakers, people who know Roy, to make sure that we're getting the Roy story right in the case of Uncle Roy. Mm-hmm. So it's a combination of, I guess, experts and people who know your subject well or love your subject, as the case may be, because you want to make sure that you're honoring all of those different perspectives, and you can kind of tell when you're getting feedback, when you're getting the same thing over and over again from different people. You're like, that's a thing then. That thing. So, yeah.
But for sure, the process is like anything. When you're in the middle of something, sometimes it's really hard to see it clearly.
Yeah.
And you need to either have the time to step back and really ponder and let the air refresh in the room, or you need other people's eyes on it. And so we were very fortunate to have our colleagues. Jen Weir looked at it. She was one of the people looking at it. An extended family friend of mine, Ann Sarnoff, who was in the more business side of the entertainment world. That's her history. She looked at it. We really tried to get people from different industries to get a different perspective. And it made a big difference.
Yeah. Huge.
Well, let's take a brief break, and then we'll come back and let's focus in on the film Uncle Roy and tell about, you know, how that came about and what it's all about.
Awesome.
You're listening to Fresh Fruit on KFAI. I'm your host, Dixie Treichel, tonight with Carrie Pickett and Dawn Mickelson. So please stay tuned. I'm going to play a song by Divine. And this is You Think You're a Man. Anyway, here it goes.
Satisfy me. Programming on KFAI is supported in part by the Hook and Ladder Theater and Lounge, presenting Beth Bambara and Mother Banjo live on the Zen Arcade Stage, Sunday, April 19th. Beth Bambara's music lives at the intersection of 70s folk soul and 90s indie rock. She's touring with her latest release, It All Goes Up, while Mother Banjo opens the show with her signature blend of indie, folk, and bluegrass songs. More information about Beth Bambara and Mother Banjo at the Hook and Ladder Theater is available at thehookmpls.com.
Support for KFAI comes from The Dakota, presenting Julius Rodriguez, Monday, April 27th. Jazz composer, drummer, pianist, and multi-instrumentalist, Julius Rodriguez is known for his deep understanding of traditional jazz with modern influences to create a distinctive voice that resonates across genres. He's touring with his latest release, Evergreen, an album that shows the importance of having no boundaries among musical genres because everything can work together with the right attention to the details. More information about Julius Rodriguez at The Dakota is available at dakotacooks.com.
All right, you're back listening to Fresh Fruit on KFAI, Fresh Air Community Radio, 90.3 FM, Minneapolis, St. Paul, around the world at kfai.org. I'm Dixie Treichel here with my guests tonight, Carrie Pickett and Dawn Mickelson, talking about film and other good things and queerness, and we're going to be talking about the film Uncle Roy. So why don't you go ahead and start, Carrie, about the film Uncle Roy. Tell us about that.
Well, Roy Blakey was born in 1930 in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and when he was 11 years old, or 10 or 11, I think, maybe 10, he saw a Sonja Henie movie, and he saw her skating on black ice, and he was mesmerized and amazed and transformed and transfixed, and that's what he, when he decided that's what he wanted to do with his life. And it just, with like a single purpose of a arrow shooting through the air, he just worked his entire teenage years and became an amazing roller skater. And he worked his way into a career in show business, performing on ice. Mm-hmm. And it was a long and winding road to get there, but he finagled and worked and found a way to make it happen. And it wasn't, it was kind of a little bit circuitous route because he got to Europe through the U.S. Army. He was stationed in Germany at a time when he could have been sent to Korea, along with a lot of other people. And he used to say, and in Korea, they were shooting at each other. And so, like, you know, he has all, he was somebody who just really considered himself lucky, 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 because he had this great passion for the arts and for figure skating. And then eventually he found his way into the sensational show Holiday on Ice International, where he traveled the globe performing on ice, which was his just ultimate dream come true. And he really was just somebody who along the way worked his skills as a photographer, and innately and inherently his life as a performer, photographing his friends, photographing the places where they were at, photographing the shows, grew his photographic skills. Mm-hmm. And he has a trail, an archive of his personal travels that is like no other, because he was such a talented photographer. And so this trail of the his photographic archive and the archive of the history of theatrical ice skating, as I mentioned, led to my first film, The Fabulous Ice Age. But really, 20 years ago, I also wanted to make a film about my uncle and his personal life. And as I made The Fabulous Ice Age, Roy's personal life got moved out of the story because it became more important to tell this history of how this art form dominated live entertainment. movement and took American culture, and people like Roy were really ambassadors to America all around the world. And so I really started this film, and my interest in Roy started as, you know, my interest in him, his life as a film, started 20 years ago. And I did the first interviews that are in the film Uncle Roy 20 years ago. And so I when I finished The Fabulous Ice Age, I really thought The Fabulous Ice Age would help me find a home for Roy's archive, because we always knew that none of us are going to live forever, and so he would need a place for his archive. And I thought that the film The Fabulous Ice Age would help us find that. And it And when it didn't, I just kept filming Roy and his life, mm-hmm. because I always hoped that I would do a film more about Roy. And so one film would come in and kind of take my attention away. After I did The Fabulous Ice Age, I focused on Winona LaDuke and her efforts to preserve treaty rights and wild rice watershed up against the Enbridge Sandpiper Pipeline. And that film was called First Daughter and the Black Snake. Mm-hmm. And that came out in 2017. And so I really went back to filming Roy quite a bit in 2018 and 2019. And then COVID came, and I really focused on caregiving, and I really continued to film, but I really felt overwhelmed and felt like I really could not finish this film by myself. And after our fabulous experience with finding her beat, I asked Dawn if she would come in and help me finish the film.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any comments on
your... Yeah, I mean, I think that Uncle Roy is really, it's a combination of things. It's celebrating Roy Blakey's life, but it's also celebrating the relationship between Carrie and her uncle, mm-hmm. you know, and it became a film. We didn't intend it this way in the beginning, but it became a film that was filmed over the last, particularly over the last year of his life. So even though it, you know, even though it was... 20 plus years of footage, this last year of his life figures prominently in the film, mm-hmm. Because it shows the unique and special relationship that those two had and how important it was for them to be in one another's lives. And so I feel like it's a film... I've been trying to figure out how to shorten the description of Uncle Roy, mm-hmm. and I can never do it. You know, the closest I think I've been coming lately is I'm like, it's a story about family, legacy, figure skating, and nude photography. And usually people are like, pardon? You know, because they get hung up on the nudes. but you know, it's really consolidating a person's 94 years of living is hard to do, mm-hmm. and especially when they lived a life as big as Roy did. But
well, and Roy was also gay, and
yes.
you know, going through the different times, starting, you know, born in the 30s and then going into whatever the 60s and in being in New York, that's probably a totally different scene in the 80s. Mm-hmm. And so how did that figure into the film, his gayness?
Well, I think that the ice shows are a sanctuary space for creatives, and so the atmosphere and culture of tolerance has always been integral to, I think, the entertainment industry, because creatives come in all colors. And the embracing that is so important for having a joyful existence in the arts. And so I think the arts have always been a safe and sanctuary space for queer people. But Roy's queerness, I think, was really something that he didn't ever talk about. He wasn't part of his something that he spoke about, because, you know, if mostly he would say, Carrie, it's not like it, you know, how it is now is not like it used to be. It used to be so different. And I think that he didn't expound upon that, but I think the weight is there that he was not, he did not grow up in a culture of freedom of expression for who he was. And that's why it was so magnificent that he found a space for that in his life. And then that space also grew into his second career as a photographer, because when he hung up his skates, he decided to stay in New York City and became a photographer to the stars. And that was when he started doing personal work again. I would say when he was a skater, when he was photographing, I would call that personal work. He wasn't getting paid by everybody to do that work. And then in the late 60s and early 70s, he started to photograph dancers nude. He did a lot of actors and people in the entertainment industry. He did their portraits, and he was really fond of photographing dancers. And so he started a personal project of male nudes, and he was interested in the light. He was interested in men wearing nothing but light. And so his book, that he self-published in 1972, has a groundbreaking place in the history of male nude photography. And that history of how he was the first person to legally publish and send through the mail this book of nudes makes him one of the forefathers of photography. And so I didn't even know about this when I started the film. It all kind of unfolded and came about because of me trying to share Roy's story and his legacy. Mm-hmm. By sharing his legacy, I learned more about the context for his legacy and the important place that that his book had in the history, where it had been illegal for a book like his to go through the mail before the DSI obscenity trials here in Minneapolis. And that story comes up in the film. But one of the things I will say about that is that the film has helped me place a lot of things into perspective. For instance, when going through Roy's personal letters and seeing all of his fan mail for his book, in 1972, he got a lot of letters from people complaining that the book had arrived cut in half or broken in half. And so now, learning, I didn't understand that, but now putting it into the context of the DSI obscenity trials, the post office didn't like the book. And so the post office people were possibly
tampering
and damaging his book, because there were so many letters. I thought, why would his book, I know he's going to pack it well, why would he get so many letters from people saying their book arrived damaged?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So anyway, one can speculate that the atmosphere has not always been as tolerant as it is now.
Right.
And even when in the making of the film, I would say the political climate has changed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, it's one of the things that I learned a lot from knowing Gene Treader over mm-hmm. the years, mm-hmm. who started the Treader Collection. Mm-hmm. And he was really big on declaring that there was indeed an LGBT culture, mm-hmm. and that everything mm-hmm. shouldn't always be focused on sex, because there's so much more to queer folk than people want to admit. And part of his thing in saving a lot of these things is because other people want to destroy them and erase mm-hmm. our history.
Right.
So the fact that you're talking about the obscenity laws and everything else, that's par for the course. And there are still people who would like to totally erase us,
right,
and our history.
And we do have a little bit of a spoiler alert here, because the placement and the search for a place for Roy's archive really goes well beyond what is mentioned in the film. Mm-hmm. And it was immense. And in the making of the film, Dawn set us up for a meeting with Friends & Co. And we brought Roy, and we told the story of about the film and the quest of to find a home for the archive. And in the process of doing that, people told us about the Treader Archive. And I did not know about the Treader.
There you go. Everyone should know about the Treader Collection.
Yeah.
Hello.
There it is. And so, Dawn, mm-hmm. you can pick up the story from here, because really the making of the film helped answer the quest of the film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I mean, that's kind of it, really. I would say that while we were making Uncle Roy, also, it's funny, when we were filming at the Treader, when was that? That was 2024.
It was
summer of 2024.
Yeah. July
and
of 2024.
Things, before you start, what you're saying is that Roy's archive is now in the Treader Collection.
It is now in the Treader Collection.
Okay, continue.
Yes. And when we were filming in the Treader Collection in 2024, Aidan Bettine showed us a book that was saved from the fires during Nazi Germany. And it really drove home that piece of our histories have been destroyed and have been actively erased. And it's interesting because when he was talking about it, I'm like, oh, I'm so glad we're in a time we're in now. And now two years later, you have these collections. I don't believe this is the case for the Treader, but the collections of the Smithsonian and other places are threatened by our current administration.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is a real threat right now. And it's strange to be releasing the film right now, actually, in that way, because when we were filming, it was like, oh, I'm so glad we're in this new space where our histories are being protected. And now it's less clear, and mm-hmm. it's worth fighting for, you know?
Yeah, yeah, it definitely is. Let's take another quick break, and we'll come back. And I think, you know, talking about preservation is really important, and we'll talk more about that. I'm here with Carrie Pickett and Dawn Mickelson. This is Dixie Treichel on Fresh Fruit. I'm going to play a piece now that I found by accident that totally surprised me. Okay, this blew my mind, all right? This is The Miracles in 1975 with Ain't Nobody Straight in L.A.
La 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 she took me the other night.
Yeah.
Hey, but wait a minute, man. That's a gay bar.
Hey, man. Ain't nothing but gay bars in Los Angeles.
Yeah, Bill, that might be true, though, but, you know, some of the finest women are in a gay bar.
Hey, but dig, Bob, how you know they women?
Well,
Hey, man, look, well, look, gay people are nice people, too, man.
Support for KFAI comes from The Fine Line, presenting a joint show from artists Maye and Ambar Lucid, Sunday, May 10th. In this emotionally raw live experience, the duo wants you to feel the power of intimacy on stage. Between Maye's alternative soul and Ambar Lucid's psychedelic pop, the two defy expectations and genres. Tickets and more information about Maye and Ambar Lucid can be found at first-avenue.com.
Support for KFAI comes from the Cedar Cultural Center, presenting Bajiki with Jada Brown on Thursday, April 30th. The trio behind Bajiki make music that aims to showcase contemporary Ojibwe culture and lifeways, combining hand drums with electronic samples and beats. Opening the show is Jada Brown, a singer and songwriter who mixes modern soul and hip-hop. More information about Bajiki with Jada Brown can be found at thecedar.org.
All right. You're tuned in to Fresh Fruit on KFAI. And we heard a song by The Miracles, Ain't Nobody Straight in L.A. I want to make a quick announcement, and then we'll be back with our filmmakers, Don Mickelson and Carrie Pickett. I wanted to mention that at the Minnesota Museum of American Art in St. Paul, there's an exhibit called Queering Indigeneity. It's an art exhibit celebrating the vision and diversity of two-spirit, native queer, gender-expansive artists in the upper Midwest. And the exhibit's going to be there until August 16th. It's free, and they're open Thursdays through Sundays, 10 to 4. You can go to mmaa.org for more information. All right, so we had some topics that we were going to talk about here at Carrie and Dawn.
Yeah, you played a song by Divine.
I did.
I mean, wow. I never think about Divine as a singer, and so that was really great. Roy made just amazing photographs of Divine and other incredibly important cultural icons in New York City at the time, like Candy Darling and Jackie Curtis. And he really was somebody who a lot of people went to for their album covers, their book covers. And I know he was very surprised when he got the call to photograph Divine, and he went down the stairs, and this, he would describe this kind of schlumpy man at the bottom of the stairs, and it was Harris Milford, Divine's alter ego. And when Divine, you know, Roy was like, well, where's Divine? And Harris said, well, as soon as my friend comes here and brings my face, then Divine will appear.
And the friend was the makeup artist.
The friend was the makeup artist.
That's funny. That is totally hilarious.
Yeah.
So we wanted to mention that the film Uncle Roy will be screening around town and maybe again at the film fest?
Well, we don't know for sure if it'll be at the fest again. We had two sold-out screenings last week that were amazing. Mm-hmm. Combination of community and people who actually knew Roy and people who didn't know Roy and wished they had. So it was a beautiful, beautiful couple of screenings. And we are talking with community organizations, so we will definitely be screening in the Twin Cities again. It's just a question of when. So we would love it if you would, you know, follow us on social media. Uncle Roy Film, I think, is the
.com.
.com.
And then the hashtag. And the at symbol.
Yeah, it's the at symbol for both Instagram and Facebook is Uncle Roy Film. So you can find the film all those places, and then we will definitely be announcing Twin Cities screenings when they happen again.
One of the things that's been really surprising is how many people have said that they have had the film come up in their conversation multiple times because it brings up so many topics. Mm. And when we were in Thessaloniki, Greece, I must say, Greece is a place where they've known about the beauty of the male nude mm-hmm. for quite some time.
Right.
Let's say 2,300 years. And I was at an after party at in the street, and I bumped into this woman who was kind of sitting at a table, and she looked up and she said, "Oh, it's you." She said, "We saw your film and we've been talking about it for 2 hours."
Wow, nice.
And that was a European in Greece who didn't know Roy, didn't know about anything in the film, had no connection, and found it thought-provoking and conversation starting. And so that's what I keep hearing from people, is how they keep returning to it and telling others about the topic and talking about it. And so I think that's amazing when, as a filmmaker, you can spur conversation and further curiosity. It's really surprising and wonderful.
I'd also throw out there that there's a lot of people we've talked to who have elders in their family that they're caregiving for in some way. Maybe it's not direct care, but sometimes it is. And it really, you know, resonates with those folks in particular because they see themselves in the story. They see their loved ones. And it's provoked some interesting conversations about queer caregiving and the elder queer community, in particular folks who didn't have children, didn't have that, you know, the kind of, when we talk about caregiving, often it's the children. And so I think Uncle Roy is an opportunity to really start having those conversations about our queer elders and family and chosen family and how we're caring for one another in this time, because there's a lot of folks who are entering those later years.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So. And then the other thing that's been surprising about the film is how many young people are really touched and moved and love it. Mm-hmm. I mean, I sat next, a woman said that the young man who was sitting next to her, who was age 20, was so emotionally moved by the film. And again, in Greece, the young people who were the volunteers and the ushers for the film kind of rushed the stage afterwards and said, you know, that they were interested in the film because they loved Roy.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And so for them, it wasn't a topical film. Mm-hmm. It was really a biographical film about Roy, and he was inspirational and exciting mm-hmm. for them. And so that was surprising. I really was very moved by that.
Mm-hmm. What kind of a response did you get here at the film fest, the folks, you know, after the film?
Very enthusiastic here. And, you know, part of that is because people not only recognized Roy, but they recognized their home. Mm-hmm. You know, this film takes place in Minneapolis. And so it's particularly special for the local community, I think. It's so many people came up to us after the screening, were like, "I've passed Carrie's office for years. She has this mm-hmm. office on Hennepin that she shared with Roy, and mm-hmm. always wondered what was happening in there." You know, so it was kind of fun. I don't know. What did you think, Carrie?
Yeah, the notes that I have gotten have been tear-inducing mm-hmm. Notes of heartfelt thanks for uplifting their faith in humanity, mm-hmm. Because Roy's positivity is infectious.
Yeah, yeah, it's really true.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful film. I hope everybody gets to see it at some point. I imagine eventually might come out on like DVD or be streaming.
Yes,
on,
eventually.
You know, someplace.
We certainly hope so.
But anyway, well, it's been great to have both of you on Fresh Fruit.
Well, thank you.
My guests again are Carrie Pickett and Dawn Mickelson, filmmakers, and give your social medias one more time.
I'm at Carrie Pickett, K-E-R-I-P-I-C-K-E-T-T, and UncleRoyFilm.com, And I'm CarriePickett.com.
And I am Emergence Girl. So it's Emergence and G-R-R-L on both, I believe that's both Instagram and Facebook. Facebook, did
faced.
I say that? Faced.
You faced it.
Yeah, I faced it. So, yeah, but you know, definitely follow Uncle Roy Film on the socials because that's where you're going to find all of the information about when it's streaming and when it's, you know, doing its thing all over the country, mm-hmm. all over the world, actually. We have festivals coming up for the next 12 months that we're pretty excited about and can't talk about most of them because they're not announced yet.
And I'm also trying to move my mailing list over to Substack.
Okay. So follow her Substack.
Sounds good. All right. Okay. Thanks, everybody, for listening to Fresh Fruit. And everybody who pledged during Pledge Drive, we love that. You can donate any time of the year you want. Just go to kfai.org. Stay tuned. Travel Ramo Fafafaz coming up next. Let's go out with a piece by Beverly McClellan called I Can't Hide Me.
Good old Beverly.
It's raining.